Chapter 28. Face, one thing is necessary to me, as the biggest corn and hay dealer in these parts. The Scotchman, who's taking the town trade, so bold into his hands, must be cut out. Do you hear? We two can't live side by side, that's clear and certain. I've seen it all, said Jopp. By fair competition I mean, of course, Henchard continued. But as hard, keen, and unflinching as fair, rather more so. By such a desperate bid against him for the farmer's custom as will grind him into the ground, starve him out. I've capital, mind ye, and I can do it. I'm all that way of thinking, said the new foreman. Jopp's dislike of Farfrae as the man who had once usurped his place, while it made him a willing tool, made him, at the same time, commercially as unsafe a colleague as Henchard could have chosen. I sometimes think, he added, that he must have some glass that he sees next year in. He has such a knack of making everything bring him fortune. He's deep beyond all honest men's discerning, but we must make him shallower. We'll undersell him, and overbuy him, and so snuff him out. They then entered into specific details of the process by which this would be accomplished, and parted at a late hour. Elizabeth Jane heard by accident that Jopp had been engaged by her stepfather. She was so fully convinced that he was not the right man for the place that, at the risk of making Henchard angry, she expressed her apprehension to him when they met. But it was done to no purpose. Henchard shut up her argument with a sharp rebuff. The season's weather seemed to favor their scheme. The time was in the years immediately before foreign competition had revolutionized the trade in grain, when still, as from the earliest stages, the wheat quotations from month to month depended entirely upon the home harvest. A bad harvest, or the prospect of one, would double the price of corn in a few weeks, and the promise of a good yield would lower it as rapidly. Prices were like the roads of the period, steep in gradient, reflecting in their phases the local conditions, without engineering, levelings, or averages. The farmer's income was ruled by the wheat crop within his own horizon, and the wheat crop by the weather. Thus in person, he became a sort of flesh barometer, with feelers always directed to the sky and wind around him. The local atmosphere was everything to him. The atmospheres of other countries a matter of indifference. The people too, who were not farmers, the rural multitude, saw in the god of the weather a more important personage than they do now. Indeed, the feeling of the peasantry in this matter was so intense, as to be almost unrealizable in these equable days. Their impulse was well nigh to prostrate themselves in lamentation before untimely rains and tempests, which came as the Alistair of those households whose crime it was to be poor. After midsummer they watched the weathercocks as men waiting in Anticomers watched the lackey. Sun elated them, quiet rain sobered them, weeks of watery tempest stupefied them. That aspect of the sky which they now regard as disagreeable they then beheld as maleficent. It was June, and the weather was very unfavorable. Casterbridge, being as it were the bellboard on which all the adjacent hamlets and villages sounded their notes, was decidedly dull. Instead of new articles, in the shop windows those that had been rejected in the foregoing summer were brought out again. Superseded reap hooks, badly shaped rakes, shop-worn leggings, and time-stiffened water tights reappeared, furbished up as near to new as possible. Henchard, backed by Jopp, read a disastrous garnering, and resolved to base his strategy against Farfrae upon that reading. But before acting he wished what, so many have wished, that he could know for certain, what was at present only strong probability. He was superstitious as such headstrong natures often are, and he nourished in his mind an idea bearing on the matter, an idea he shrank from disclosing even to Jopp. In a lonely hamlet a few miles from the town, so lonely that what are called lonely villages were teeming by comparison, there lived a man of curious repute as a forecaster or weather prophet. The way to his house was crooked and miry, even difficult in the present unpropitious season. One evening when it was raining so heavily that ivy and laurel resounded like distant musketry, and an outdoor man could be excused for shrouding himself to his ears and eyes, such a shrouded figure on foot might have been perceived traveling in the direction of the hazel copse which dripped over the prophet's cot. The turnpike road became a lane, the lane a cart track, the cart track a bridle path, the bridle path a footway, the footway overgrown. The solitary walker slipped here and there, and stumbled over the natural springes formed by the brambles, till at length he reached the house, which, with its garden, was surrounded with a high, dense hedge. The cottage, comparatively a large one, had been built of mud by the occupier's own hands, and thatched also by himself. Here he had always lived, and here it was assumed he would die. He existed on unseen supplies, for it was an anomalous thing that while there was hardly a soul in the neighborhood, but affected to laugh at this man's assertions, uttering the formula, "There's nothing in 'em," with full assurance on the surface of their faces, very few of them were unbelievers in their secret hearts. Whenever they consulted him, they did it for a fancy. When they paid him, they said, "Just a trifle for Christmas, or and Lima's, as the case might be." He would have preferred more honesty in his clients, and less sham ridicule, but fundamental belief consoled him for superficial irony. As stated, he was enabled to live. People supported him with their backs turned. He was sometimes astonished that men could profess so little and believe so much at his house, when the church they professed so much and believed so little. Behind his back he was called Ido, on account of his reputation, to his face R. Fall. The hedge of his garden formed an arch over the entrance, and a door was inserted as in a wall. Outside the door the tall traveler stopped, bandaged his face with a handkerchief, as if he were suffering from toothache, and went up the path. The window shutters were not closed, and he could see the prophet within, preparing his supper. An answer to the knock fall came to the door, candle in hand. The visitor stepped back a little from the light, and said, "Can I speak to ye?" in significant tones. The other's invitation to come in was responded to by the country formula, "This will do, thank ye," after which the householder had no alternative but to come out. He placed the candle on the corner of the dresser, took his hat from a nail, and joined the stranger in the porch, shutting the door behind him. "I've long heard that you can do things of a sort," began the other, repressing his individuality as much as he could. "Maybe so, Mr. Henchard," said the weathercaster. "Ah, why do you call me that?" asked the visitor with a start. "Because it's your name. Feeling you'd come, I've waited for ye, and thinking you might be leery from your walk, I laid two supper plates looky here." He threw open the door, and disclosed the supper table, at which appeared a second chair, knife, and fork, plate, and mug, as he had declared. Henchard felt like Saul at his reception by Samuel. He remained in silence for a few moments, then throwing off the disguise of frigidity which he had hitherto preserved, he said, "Then I have not come in vain. Now, for instance, can ye charm away warts? Without trouble. Cure the evil? That I've done with consideration, if they will wear the toad bag by night as well as by day. Forecast the weather? With labor and time. Then take this," said Henchard. "'Tis a crown piece. Now, what is the harvest fortnight to be? When can I know? Apostrophe, I've worked it out already, and you can know at once." The fact was that five farmers had already been there on the same errand from different parts of the country. Why the sun, moon, and stars, by the clouds, the winds, the trees, and grass, the candle flame and swallows, the smell of the herbs, likewise by the cat's eyes, the ravens, the leeches, the spiders, and the ding mixen, the last fortnight in August will be rain and tempest. You are not certain, of course? As one can be in a world where all's unsure. 'Twill be more like living in Revelations this autumn than in England. Shall I sketch it out for ye in a scheme? Oh no, no, said Henchard. don't altogether believe in forecasts. Come to second thoughts on such. But you don't is quite understood, said Wido, without a sound of scorn. You have given me a crown, because you won too many. But won't you join me at supper, now 'tis waiting and all? Henchard would gladly have joined, for the savor of the stew had floated from the cottage into the porch with such appetizing distinctness that the meat, the onions, the pepper, and the herbs could be severally recognized by his nose. But as sitting down to hob and nob there would have seemed to mark him too implicitly as the weathercaster's apostle, he declined, and went his way. The next Saturday Henchard bought grain to such an enormous extent that there was quite a talk about his purchases among his neighbors, the lawyer, the wine merchant, and the doctor, also on the next, and on all available days. When his granaries were full to choking, all the weathercocks of Casterbridge creaked and set their faces in another direction, as if tired of the southwest. The weather changed. The sunlight, which had been like tin for weeks, assumed the hues of topaz. The temperament of the welkin passed from the phlegmatic to the sanguine. An excellent harvest was almost a certainty, and as a consequence prices rushed down. All these transformations, lovely to the outsider, to the wrong-headed corn dealer were terrible. He was reminded of what he had well known before, that a man might gamble upon the square green areas of fields as readily as upon those of a card room. Henchard had backed bad weather, and apparently lost. He had mistaken the turn of the flood for the turn of the ebb. His dealings had been so extensive that settlement could not long be postponed, and to settle he was obliged to sell off corn that he had bought only a few weeks before at figures higher by many shillings a quarter. Much of the corn he had never seen. It had not even been moved from the ricks in which it lay stacked miles away. Thus he lost heavily. In the blaze of an early August day he met Farfrae in the marketplace. Farfrae knew of his dealings, though he did not guess their intended bearing on himself, and commiserated him, for since their exchange of words in the south walk they had been on stiffly speaking terms. Henchard for the moment appeared to resent the sympathy, but he suddenly took a careless turn. "Oh, no, no! Nothing serious, man!" he cried with fierce gaiety. "These things always happen, don't they? I know it has been said that figures have touched me tight lately, but is that anything rare? The case is not so bad as folk make out, perhaps. And dammy, a man must be a fool to mind the common hazards of trade." But he had to enter the Casterbridge Bank that day for reasons which had never before sent him there, and to sit a long time in the partner's room with a constrained bearing. It was rumored soon after that much real property as well as vast stores of produce, which had stood in Henchard's name in the town and neighborhood, was actually the possession of his bankers. Coming down the steps of the bank he encountered Jopp. The gloomy transactions just completed within had added fever to the original sting of Farfrae's sympathy that morning, which Henchard fancied might be a satire disguised, so that Jopp met with anything but a bland reception. The latter was in the act of taking off his hat to wipe his forehead, and saying, "A fine hot day," to an acquaintance. "You can wipe and wipe, and say, 'A fine hot day, apostrophe can he,'" cried Henchard in a savage undertone, imprisoning Jopp between himself and the bank wall. "If it hadn't been for your blasted advice it might have been a fine day enough. Why did he let me go on, hey? When a word of doubt from you, or anybody would have made me think twice. For you can never be sure of whether 'tis past. My advice, sir, was to do what you thought best. A useful fellow. And the sooner you help somebody else in that way the better." Henchard continued his address to Jopp in similar terms till it ended in Jopp's dismissal there and then, Henchard turning upon his heel and leaving him. "You shall be sorry for this, sir, sorry as a man can be," said Jopp, standing pale, and looking after the corn merchant as he disappeared in the crowd of market men hard by. 27. It was the eve of harvest. prices being low, Farfrae was buying. As was usual, after reckoning too surely on famine weather, the local farmers had flown to the other extreme, and, in Farfrae's opinion, were selling off too recklessly. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.